Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jason Smith. I'm here with my colleague, Derek Ankrum. We represent Nolan Fogel and Fogel Enterprises. This is a case in which the respondent certified the plaintiff's requested class, despite the plaintiff's failure, in our opinion, complete failure, to meet the elements of Rule 5208, and respondent further certified the class in a manner which deprives our clients of their due process rights. Frankly, in our view, if the certification in respondent's order is upheld here, it will represent a drastic departure from established precedent from this court and from other courts around the country, including the United States Supreme Court. I want to start by diving into the constitutional issues because I think they're very important issues before the court. What respondent in this case adopted was a process that will allow a monetary judgment to be entered against my clients for plaintiffs who have no claim against my clients, to people who have not come to court and asserted any type of claim against my clients, for damages that my clients didn't cause, and without giving my clients any opportunity to defend against that judgment. Under plaintiff's theory of the case, which the respondent adopted here, a class member would be entitled to a monetary judgment against my clients without us being allowed to challenge that class member's claims, and frankly, without us even knowing who that class member was. And we've cited a long list of cases that we think make it very clear that that is not permissible.
You're talking about the fluid recovery. What are there situations in which that is appropriate to set up a fund up front when you can't identify class members?
I don't believe so, Judge Stith. There are cases that fluid recovery has been approved for a post-judgment distribution process, but I don't believe it's appropriate to use this aggregate judgment fluid recovery process that the plaintiffs advocated for. I don't believe that that's appropriate to use that as a method of assessing damages to begin with. And that's where we get into the due process.
And that's in part because you're saying you're assessing damages on a larger group than are actually in the class.
Absolutely. You're assessing damages based on mere theoretical liability. We have defenses to class members' claims. Those are established. I believe they're uncontroverted that we have the ability to defend, and we have defenses available to certain class members' claims. What the respondent's order has done is it has said, you don't get to raise those defenses before a judgment's entered. We're going to take the total amount of the CDF that was paid that you've collected. We're going to enter a judgment for that amount, and then we'll figure it out later.
But couldn't you defend that judgment before it's entered and argue that only a certain percentage of the customers were involved in a customer relationship versus a business relationship? Couldn't you present that evidence to the court or to a jury and let them determine that?
Well, certainly we could, Judge Powell, but I think that presents a couple of problems. I think, number one, that absolutely flips the class certification burden on its head. The burden in this case, as in any class action, is on the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to come forward and prove not only the elements of their claims, not only the elements of class certification, but also damages. That's the plaintiff's burden.
But I think the question suggests, couldn't you narrow it later on? But my understanding is the fund would remain the same whether or not you were able to prove that or not under the plaintiff's approach.
That's the plaintiff's approach that the respondent adopted.
Some later point.
That's correct, Judge Stiff. That's what plaintiffs asked the court to do, and that's what the respondent did in this case. The respondent said, you can see it in the respondent's order. The liability is going to be $374,000 regardless of how many claimants ultimately come forward.
Is there a difference in how we should approach the analysis of this case if, say, you could know that there would be 10% of the named class members who you could probably never identify versus here where you're saying the vast majority you can't identify them? Does that fit into the calculus, or is it?
Well, I think the problem that you run into, even in your hypothetical, here I think it's very clear that the class members can't be identified, and it is the vast majority, if not the overwhelming majority. As we stand here today, despite millions of potential class members being out there, the plaintiffs have identified exactly one class member after 3.5 years of litigation, and that's the plaintiff. So this is a situation where the class members, they can't be identified. The plaintiffs have tried, and they can't do it. But even under your hypothetical, if it was 10% of the class members that couldn't be identified, we would still have these problems. You still have a large number of people out there. In this case, if it was 10%, hundreds of thousands of class members that hadn't been identified, that we wouldn't have the ability to defend against their claims. We wouldn't have the ability to raise our defenses and contest whether they're entitled to any money to begin with. But there would still be a judgment entered against my clients for that amount of money. My clients would still have their property taken. And that's really where we get into the due process issues. The respondent's order threatens to take my client's property without the ability to raise our defenses to those claims. And we've got a long list of cases that say you can't do that, including the Dukes versus Walmart case out of the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's separate and apart from the due process issue, is that also an issue of ascertainability and class definition?
It is, Your Honor. Absolutely. And I think the two issues really go hand in hand here. We have the due process considerations. And the due process considerations are of course, very important. Those are constitutional issues that this court has for over 100 years said we have to protect against. But what that really gets into is, why did the plaintiffs propose this theory? There are grave constitutional concerns here. And so it begs the question, with those concerns and with the case law as it is, why would the plaintiffs ask respondent to do this? Why wouldn't the plaintiffs just go about class certification like they would in any case? Well, the answer is because we have the ascertainability and identification issues. They knew that they couldn't go about it the way that they should have. They knew that they couldn't go about obtaining certification in a traditional sense. So they came up with this really novel process that I don't think has been adopted by any court in this state to try to get there. And on that point, there's a couple of issues that really go hand in hand when we talk about identifying class members and ascertainability. It's the breadth of the class definition, and then it's whether the class members, of course, can be identified. And those are principles that derive from a long line of Missouri cases, and I think most recently the Coca-Cola case that this court handed down in 2008. And what those cases say is twofold. First, the cases say you can't have a class definition that includes people that haven't been injured. And then those cases also say those that are class members, those that are included in the class, well, you have to be able to identify them in some manner. And we believe that both of those principles are pretty clearly violated here. And I think we should look first at the class definition on that point. The class definition that respondent certified is a class of everyone who paid a CDF, who paid the fee. Well, the evidence before the trial court, before respondent, which was undisputed, is that there is a significant number of people or customers who paid the CDF that don't have a valid claim against my clients. We can look first at the MMPA claim. There's a significant number, again, undisputed evidence in the record backs this up. There's a significant number of customers who paid the CDF that did so as part of a business purchase, a business transaction. They don't have standing to bring a claim under the MMPA. There's a significant number of customers who paid the CDF knowingly. They saw the signage in the restaurants that talked about what the CDF was. They may have talked to their server about what it was. They may have understood what it was and said, we're going to pay that anyway. That's a significant number of customers. We have a voluntary payment defense on the unjust enrichment and money had received claims for those customers. So this class definition, anyone who paid a CDF, it certainly includes a significant number of customers who we would have defenses to and who likely would not have a valid claim against us. And that's the Coca-Cola case. The Coca-Cola case says, when you have that situation, you've got a bad class definition. It's too broad. And then the issue of identification, of course, is in the same vein. Everyone acknowledged these class members can't be identified. You can see it in respondent's order. She acknowledges they can't be identified. And as I mentioned earlier, the history of this litigation proves they can't be identified. Millions and millions of customers who paid this fee 3.5 years into the litigation.
Has there been an effort in the record to try to identify any others, or just note there's only one class plaintiff?
Judge Stiff, there was an effort to try to identify others. and the plaintiff in the case conducted discovery on that issue. The plaintiff in the case asked for all the records that my clients had relating to who their customers were. They went and they looked at the records that we had. They asked us who our credit card processors were. We told them who our credit card processors were. They tried to do it the right way. They knew that they had an obligation to do it the right way. But what they realized when they got into it was, oh, we can't actually comply with what the Supreme Court's told us to do, so we're going to have to go a different direction. We're going to have to come up with some different way of potentially getting there.
Counsel, since 04, certification usually comes up on appeal, and then you get permission from the Court of Appeals to appeal, and it proceeds that way. I'm sure I've either forgotten or didn't notice it, but why are we here on an original writ?
Well, Your Honor, we asked the Court of Appeals for permission to appeal, and they denied that. And then what this court's prior precedent says is that if the Court of Appeals denies us permission to appeal, we can seek further relief from this court.
And there's a statute that says when a class is certified, you can ask for the Court of Appeals as a discretionary matter to allow an immediate appeal.
Correct.
And then we had a case that says you can't seek transfer, you have to ask for a writ.
That's correct. I think that's the Coca-Cola case.
But is the question really then whether the Court of Appeals should have, is the question permission to appeal, or is the question the underlying merits of the trial court's action?
I'm not sure I understand your question. We asked the Court of Appeals for permission.
Right.
They denied that. Further relief is available from this court.
Right.
Via writ.
But in order to get the Court of Appeals to hear the case, they have to grant permission. It seems odd if you can come to this court and skip that step completely and reach the underlying merits, which apparently the Court of Appeals did not believe should be reached.
Well, Your Honor, I guess my response to that question would be, this is a procedural vehicle that's available to us. This is the writ in this situation.
That's what we said in Coca-Cola you should do.
In Coca-Cola, this is what the court instructed those agreed by a class certification order to do. The court in Coca-Cola, which is a 2008 case, of course, took the writ, issued a preliminary writ, made it permanent, which is what we're asking the court to do here. Thank you. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Fogle implemented an automatic, systematic CDF that was charged to each and every customer, unless that customer affirmatively stood up and said, no, I don't want to pay this. Through that automatic, systematic collection of this fee, Fogle took in approximately $375,000. Fogle deposited that into its general operating account, and Mr. Fogle testified that he could use it however he wanted. In fact, he used it more than 200,000 of it on his personal softball team to travel around the country. Other amounts are unaccounted for. Fogle admits it was never registered as a charity in the state of Missouri. We allege, and this is really important, we do allege that every single class member was injured. And we don't suggest that there are uninjured class members in our class definition. Our theory of the case is that everybody, no matter if they paid with a business credit card or if they thought they knew what they were paying for, they were still injured. That is our theory of the case.
Why were they injured if they knew what they were paying for?
Because you don't have the voluntary payment doctrine under the MMPA or under the common law when it's an illegal act. And this was an illegal fee under Chapter 407. So that defense is not going to be available to Fogle when we do get to the merits of the case.
Did they represent they were a charity? Is that your allegation?
Yeah, it was for community development. It was for charitable giving. And so one defense that we're going to win for class-wide is unclean hands. Another defense we're going to win class-wide is you have to know what is happening. You have to have the full knowledge of all the facts for the voluntary payment doctrine. How could anybody have known? They haven't come forward with a single individual who's subject to either of these two defenses. And they certainly haven't come forward with somebody who said, yeah, you know what, I knew Nolan Fogle spent this on my softball team.
Well, why haven't you come up with anyone else? Who's in your class? Have you identified anyone other than your plaintiff?
Yeah, our class is the every single person who paid the fee, and it's undisputed.
Have you identified any person who paid the fee other than your plaintiff?
Well, we haven't. So when the court certified the case, the next move, the court asked us to identify our class notice plan. So one of the things we plan to do, we haven't even gotten there yet, which is one of the big points I want to make today, is this: we're here really early. We don't know where things are going to go. Nobody does. But we're going to ask for a class list. We're going to ask for the credit card records. We're going to ask for their frequent dining cards. People that do that. We're going to ask for the checks.
So
we know those things exist.
That you've already done that discovery?
Could we have done the discovery?
No, that you already have. I understood opposing counsel say you've already done that discovery.
We did discovery to see what's out there.
Have you already done that discovery?
No, we have not asked them for a class list. So in my practice, in every class action we've had, we don't get the class list until after the class is certified. In fact, the defendant wouldn't produce us a class list.
How are you going to do you agree with opposing counsel that the MMPA is just for consumer class actions and that business customers cannot be a part of the class?
So you look at the nature of the transaction. The law defines a plaintiff to be a person under the MMPA. Person is defined to include corporations. And what you're looking at is whether the transaction is primarily for a customer or consumer or household purpose. And here, they're eating food. It's not a commercial.
But the people who made the purchases, if we disagree with that and think you have to make a purchase under it in order to be the consumer who's being protected, and businesses made a large percentage of the purchases, how are you going to... isn't your class definition too broad?
No. There are multiple... Again, we haven't gotten there yet. One, we do think we're going to win on that issue. We haven't litigated.
But that's the upfront question, defining the class before you can do a class list. You have to define the class. And if you're incorrect on, I understand your argument in your brief about why everybody who eats food is a consumer, but if we were to disagree with that, how does that affect the appropriateness of your class definition?
There are a couple steps there. If I'm wrong about that, but I'm right about voluntary payment, then you still have a class award of $375,000 that's appropriate.
Why is that?
Because you don't have the business versus consumer defense available to our common law claims. So they have to run the table. They have to win each and every one of their defenses in order to minimize the class membership. And so first of all, they've got to do that. And we don't know if they're going to do that. That's kind of a point in our briefing. But then, let's say that they do run the table. They win every defense. We don't win summary judgment on them, which we think we will. Now we have an aggregate verdict. We have the verdict of, let's say, we don't know what it's going to be. Maybe they'll win. But let's say we win. Let's say it's $374,000 and change. Now what we do is the court publishes notice, and we have the people who do get on the class list. We provide notice, and people have the right to come in and make their claim. And this is important, too. Fogel's going to get the chance to defend those claims. We never suggested they don't get to defend.
But it won't reduce the fund, you're saying. So why would they spend money defending individual claims when it makes no difference to their liability?
It would reduce the fund. If someone comes in and says, yeah, I've got a claim, and they defend it, and the person doesn't have a claim, it would reduce the fund.
But if no one comes in, then they have no one to defend against, and yet it still doesn't reduce the claim.
It might. What we told the trial court and what we mentioned to this court is then the trial court has an option. The trial court has several options. One option is Cypre, to send the money where it was supposed to go in the first place, to local charities. But another option is a reversion. If a certain amount of people come in and claim and they have appropriate claims, the trial court will get to hear arguments about whether it's more appropriate to send it to the state, to send it to local charities, or to let it revert to the defendant. So even if defendant runs the table, even if defendant's able to show that $375,000 is the wrong amount, they're still going to be able to keep their money potentially through a reversion process that this court has set out and said it's one of the options when there's money left over in a class award.
How is the defense going to defend that? How are they going to show that fund should be lower than? I know you can't do their job for them, but what would you envision how they do that?
Well, there are essentially two ways. First is the original fund in the trial court. Nolan Fogel was able to estimate the amount of people who, I can't remember, he was able to estimate the amount of customers who who come in for a certain reason or another. So it may be that at trial they say, look, 25% of our customers are business customers, and so you have to ding the award by 25% if they win that. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is for people who come in and do file claims to defend those, to say, no, I don't think this is a correct claim, or let me see proof that you used a personal credit card. And then they're going to be able to subtract those claims out that are improper claims. And ultimately, they may be able to subtract all of the claims that people don't come forward for and have a valid claim. In other words, they may end up receiving a significant reversion. Again, I think that's a premature. I mean, the argument here is our due process rights have been violated. How? If we win on their defenses, or if the court fashions a remedy to make sure that they're protected and that it's fair, how have their due process rights been violated by certification? Certification is an interlocutory order that the trial court has discretion to manage throughout the entire process.
How is this different from Coca-Cola, where we said that it was inappropriate to certify the class because there was no way to identify who actually was happy and who was sad and who was injured by the fact that a different sweetener was used in the drink?
I'm glad you asked that. There are two huge distinctions between this case and Coca-Cola. The first one is Coca-Cola required a subjective state of mind. Did you like saccharin, didn't
you? But this does too, whether you wanted to pay it or not.
And that's the second difference, and they work together, is in Coca-Cola, the plaintiff's theory of the case was that only 20% of their class was injured. The plaintiff's expert said 80% of the class is not injured in this case. Our theory of the case is that 100% of the class was injured.
Well, not under the MMPA.
It is. Our theory, and that's what the trial court has to look to. There's a lot of confusion about what you do with the merits of the case. And one of the things you do, you can look at the merits as the trial court. You have to look at the merits of the case. You have to look at the facts to figure out what the issues are going to be in the case. But what you can't do is decide, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure plaintiffs are going to lose on these theories. The trial court has to assume that under our theory, if we have a path to certification, if we have a path to common questions predominating, it can't rule that we lose on the MMPA. It has to assume that we will win.
You take a preliminary look for the purpose of determining commonality, typicality, and class definition.
Right. I agree. The court can look at it and say, this is going to be such a central issue that it's going to predominate. But courts in Missouri and nationwide have said this business versus consumer distinction does not override predominating common questions. It doesn't defeat predominance. We've cited multiple cases, both from this state and federal courts, to say, no, that does not defeat common questions. You can go have a questionnaire. There are ways to get around this issue. So I don't think that it doesn't arise to defeat the questions that were before the trial court, which were, do common questions predominate, and is a class mechanism superior? And it doesn't get there. You know, what Fogel's saying is, it was really easy to systematically take $375,000, but geez, it may at some point get too hard. It may at some point violate our rights, but it hasn't happened yet. And that's why the Rule 23 and the Rule 5208 standard is you certify as soon as practicable, and that the court will manage the case and decide if it becomes impractical, if the management becomes too much of a burden, then the court can decertify. I wonder if the court, let me talk about Coca-Cola just for another minute. Again, the big distinction I see is that our theory is everybody's injured. Their theory is only 20% were injured. And that's a lot of the cases that defendant cites, that is the big distinction, where it's a very small portion of the class. Or, for example, Justice, your case, where there's a nuisance. The plaintiffs allege a nuisance and they draw an arbitrary line, circle around the nuisance and say, some of these people may have been injured. We're not sure which ones. We have no idea. Contrast that with our case where we say every single person who paid this fee was injured. Again, we don't know what might happen. We could win, we could lose, we could win but lose the defenses. There are too many permutations now to just throw the baby out with the bathwater. I wonder if the court may have taken this case, and I won't ever know, but on the ascertainability issue, because it is a hot topic, coast to coast, the courts have been ruling on this. Even since this trial court decision came down, multiple appellate courts have decided. The Seventh Circuit case in Mullins, and if there's one case I could beg you to read, it would be Mullins. It's the most like this case, and it's well-reasoned and thought out. But you also have the Brasino case from the Ninth Circuit that came out during this case, and you also have the Sandusky case from the Eighth Circuit where Judge Benton said, look, we're not going to read additional factors into Rule 23. There is no heightened ascertainability requirement in Rule 23, and there isn't in Rule 5208 either. And so that's what all these courts have in common, is they say this heightened ascertainability requirement, where you're saying you have to come forward with a class list at the beginning of at class certification, that's wrong. And it's wrong for many reasons. It's unfair, but it's also wrong because Rule 5208 or Rule 23 do not require it, never have, and they don't in the Eighth Circuit, and they don't in the Seventh, they don't in the Ninth, and the majority trend of case law is going with us, saying you don't have to have this list. There is no requirement.
So, counsel, so at some point in time, based on your theory, this case goes forward, they raise all their issues, and you believe they're going to get due process. So let's say they disagree and they file a motion to decertify. Can that then be appealed through the statute that both Judge Stith and Judge Wilson mentioned, and or do they have a writ opportunity? Or is this their kind of their last go if they disagree with the trial court's decision?
That's a good question that I don't know the answer to. I would think that I don't know if there's been a case that's decided that. I would think that the decertification decision is such a major event that maybe that's an available remedy. It's also something that may happen close to trial, where usually what I've seen, a decertification decision coincides with a summary judgment decision or something that may kill the plaintiff's case. And so, you know, one option would be the parties could agree to go up at that point. But I don't know the answer. I know which rule you're talking about, the subsection F. I don't know if that would apply here, but I think it would be a very good policy that it did apply because, you don't want to go to trial if you don't have to and if there's a question that's out there. But it does usually happen right around the trial. You know, I just have a few seconds left. I want to point out that they didn't cite any cases that suggest that legal fee cases are routinely certified. This isn't an outlier of a case. And, you know, in this state, I just don't think we should have an ascertainability requirement where you could commit widespread fraud in Missouri, keep poor records of that fraud, and get away with it scot-free. That can't be the law of Missouri. Thank you.
I want to address how Mr. Dirks both began and ended his argument, because this has been the plaintiff's theme of this case from its filing until we stand here today. The plaintiff's theme has been Nolan Fogel and Fogel Enterprises, these are bad people, and they've done a bad thing, and you can't let them get away with it. And I want to say as a preliminary matter, we disagree with the characterization of my client's conduct. We think they're wrong. We think they've mischaracterized it. They want to say Nolan Fogel and Fogel Enterprises are bad people and they've lied to people. We disagree with that. But let's set that aside. Let's assume that's true. Let's assume that my clients have lied to everybody and have stolen their money. That doesn't give the plaintiffs a free pass at class certification. That doesn't mean that the plaintiff doesn't have to satisfy the elements of its claims. That doesn't mean that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove its damages. And there's a great case, we've cited it in our brief, and I read it again yesterday, and I read it from start to finish, and it's Ex Parte Nelson. It's a case that this court decided in 1913. Now, some people would call that old law. I'm going to call it well-established law. And the discussion of due process in that case is, it's both entertaining, but it's also directly on point. And What the court in Ex parte Nelson talked about in the context of due process, it said, you know, due process, this is a bedrock principle in our country. And let's look at the people who assassinated Presidents Garfield and McKinley. These are the worst of the worst criminals out there. They murdered our presidents. And everybody knows they did it. They committed these atrocious crimes. But when they went to trial, their trials were conducted just as if they were a king or a prince. They had the same due process rights as everybody else.
Counsel, you just have about a minute left. Would you comment on your opponent's argument about ascertainability and what the Superior Circuit has said?
I'm sorry? The
ascertainability issue and what various circuits have said on that, would you respond to his
argument? Well, the ascertainability issue, I agree with it. It's a hot-button issue right now. And there are courts around the country that are going a whole bunch of different directions with ascertainability. But at the end of the day, what I think we can all agree on is that you have to be able to identify your class. Your method of doing that may look different in certain situations, but at the end of the day, to protect due process rights under this court's precedent in previous cases, you have to be able to identify your case class in some manner.
Why isn't due process protected so long as you have the right to appeal?
So long as we have the right to appeal?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the legislature gave a discretionary right to appeal, which the court denied. You're here asking for an extraordinary writ. If the preliminary writ was quashed without opinion, you still have a trial and an appeal.
And how would you? And I see my time's up, but if I can answer with permission to answer your question. The problem here is that the plaintiff's entire theory of class certification that respondent adopted, the reason that this case was certified was because the plaintiff came up with this theory that they're going to be able to get a judgment against us before we have the opportunity to raise our defenses. That's a grave injustice, and that's something that needs to be corrected right now. Before we go through the time and expense of very costly class action litigation, I defend and bring lots of different types of cases. The most expensive cases to litigate are class actions. These are extremely expensive, and this is the time to correct the wrong.
Can you address quickly opposing counsel's argument that even if we were to agree with some of your arguments, for instance, that business customers are a large percent of the class definition and so forth, and they wouldn't have an MMPA claim, he's also brought common law claims, yeah, and that everybody who paid the tax would be part of that?
Yeah, I absolutely can respond to that. We've cited the case in our brief of Edwards versus the City of Ellisville, and I think that case is directly on point. It's a 2013 case, I believe, out of the Eastern District Court of Appeals. And here's what that case says. It was a case involving red light cameras, and the City of Ellisville had its red light cameras up. People were running the red lights. They were sending them their tickets, and people were paying their fines. Well, that was ultimately deemed to be inappropriate and illegal, that they couldn't be doing that. So what happens? Well, somebody sues them in a class action, says we want all of our money back. And what the Court of Appeals said there, it said, if you voluntarily paid for that, even if it was later determined to be illegal, that they were sending you that bill to begin with, if you received it and you voluntarily paid it, then the voluntary payment defense applies in that situation, applies to your claim now that you're trying to get that money back. So I think that case addresses the voluntary payment discussion that my opponent has brought.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.